You're listening to Retronauts, a part of the HyperX Podcast Network. Find us and more great shows like us at podcast.hyperx.com.
This week on Retronauts, surprise and terror. The juice is boiling. Everybody, welcome to Retronauts. I am your host for this week, Nadia Oxford of the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. Thank you so much for joining me. Today, we're going into deep space, then hyperspace, and maybe even quasi-space as we talk about one of the greatest adventure games of all time, Star Control. Well, mostly Star Control 2 and Urquan Masters, but we'll throw in a hello to Star Control on our way. I'm honored to actually be joined on this episode by two of my great and very old friends. Sorry for saying old, but it's true. Siobhan Butt and Scott Sharkey, both avid fans of Star Control, like probably more than me, and that's pretty scary. Go ahead and say hi. You first, Siobhan.
Hello. It's good to be back on this show. I've been actually asking Parrish to do a StarCon 2 episode since Retronauts started. So,
wow.
You know, 17 years of patience, and I finally got there.
You did. Your patience really paid off. I said, you know what? I should just do a Star Control 2 episode. And I said to Parrish, are you okay with that? And he said, sure. That's good.
I don't know why he didn't just let me do it, but I guess I'm just a perennial guest and not the permanent host.
You're a guest and a great friend. And you're a good mollusk. I don't know what you would call a spathi, but there you go. Sharky, it's been like 50,000 space ages. How are you?
It's been a long time, yeah. It's funny. I actually wanted to do this back when I was hosting this, like 15 years ago.
Wow. So I'm very happy that I managed to make your dreams come true in a roundabout way. That gives me great honor.
You laugh, Nadia, but when you did send me the text saying, hey, you want to be on a StarCon episode? I was literally like, yes, right now. Let's go.
I got my microphone out. Let's get this done.
Oh, yeah, this was one of the first things I wrote about, like in computer gaming world, like early 2000s.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, because I had that column on just like, you know, free and indie games. And this was one of the first ones I did.
Yeah. I was actually going to ask you gentlemen, how you got into like Star Control in general. Sharky, since you started, go ahead and talk some more about your history with the game.
I had a friend who had the Genesis game way back.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we mostly just played the Super Melee. Like the campaign stuff, I barely dip my toes in. And it's not bad, but it is, you know, it's an early like turn-based strategy game with like basically fancy space war in between.
Yes, yeah, StarCon 1 definitely felt like space wars with graphics, right? Like 1950s era space war with a little bit of upside.
It had a lot of character, but most of the story is in the manual. Like it's not a lot to it.
For sure.
The good era when manuals actually carried the weight of the game.
Even Star Control 2 kind of does that. I remember getting the game and I still have the manual and it's just like I was kind of just sitting on my floor of my apartment, my little hobbit hole apartment, just reading it and being like, wow, this is so cool.
There's a lot of world building in it.
There really is.
Yes, there is. Like, I remember reading the manual of StarCon 2, and it's like, and the aliens came and shot lasers into these places in, like, South America where nobody knew civilization was. And I'm like, oh, my God, I want to know that story.
Oh, yeah. They like vaporized Atlantis, and it's like a footnote.
Yeah.
I love that. There is a mention of that, isn't there, in the instruction booklet, the Urquan conquered Earth, and they start shooting up places the humans have no idea why they're shooting up.
They're like, we're attacking all of the places that are advanced civilizations, and we're like, there's nothing out there.
Why did you laser the Atlantic?
Like, turns out there's nothing there now. My history with StarCon, I did not play the first one until way later. I definitely got into StarCon 2. Mm-hmm. Like, my best friend who lived next door to me, his dad was one of the 1970s nerds who had, like, you know, ham radios and electronic stuff and seven hard drives in his computer when everybody didn't know what a hard drive was. And they would get all the cool new computer games all the time because his dad was like a proto nerd. And one of the ones they got was StarCon 2. Wow. And so I used to go to his house all the time and we would be sitting there and just, you know, in awe of how expansive and amazing this game is. Like, we're going to talk about it for the next X amount of time. But so I won't go in too far, but let's just put it this way. We were so addicted to this game that the copyright protection for this game, when you log on, it would give you a star and coordinates and then say, name the constellation. And you're supposed to pull out the big fancy map. Star map they had and, you know, type in the name. We lost that star map because we were kids. Yeah. However, we had played StarCon so much that we literally could just keep refreshing until it got to Seoul. And then we knew where Seoul was, and we were able to put in the coordinates for that and get into the game. That and, like, Horologi. And we were sitting there and, like, because we're 12, Horologi, come on, it's like...
Yeah, do not forget that.
Yeah, but, like, we were literally, like, looking at this map, and we would be looking at the coordinates and kind of like, okay, on the mouse pad, where is this? Oh, yeah, there we go. And then we went and wrote out the entire coordinates of every single star on a notepad that I think I still have somewhere. Just to prove a point.
It's one of those world maps that sticks with you. Like, I know people talk about, like, I could still play Zelda with my eyes shut or whatever, but, like, I remember the Star Control 2 map. Like, I could Delta Gorno is at, like, you know, 200, whatever.
Exactly. Like, you remember where the portal for the Aralu is. You remember where, like, these important planets are. And when you look at just, like, when I fired it up again in prep for this episode, and I just went to the star map, and I'm like, holy crap, there are a lot of stars.
Yes.
And every last star has been deliberately placed. Every one of them has, like, anywhere from 1 to, like, 12 to 15 planets. Every one of those planets has been handcrafted and individually placed. And I'm like, this is the most, like, nowadays, this would be, like, all procedurally generated or something.
Right.
But this was bespoke as hell. And I'm just like, damn, these guys spent hours plunking down random aliens on every last dot of this planet. That's nuts to me now.
It owes a lot to Starflight.
Yeah.
And if you even look at that game, even if you haven't played it, it looks like Star Control, because Star Control just drew a lot from it. And there's a lot of cross-pollination between the people who made those games, too.
Yeah.
Like, was it Paul Ritchie?
Paul Reich.
Reich. Okay. Yeah. I can never remember how to pronounce his name. I think that was probably actually, like, the first thing I was familiar with him doing was, like, Mail Order Monsters. And I guess back when he was supposed to be working on that, he was, like, helping with Starflight.
That's amazing.
Years later, it came together as this.
Yeah, like, from what I understand, though, this is also kind of their, like, their electronic version of their old Star Frontiers RPG game that they were playing. The old TSR, basically, it's like a science fiction role-playing game, kind of like D&D, but in space. And they borrowed a lot of their home campaign to make this kind of, this world for this game.
Wow, Dragonlance in space.
You know, it's like Spelljammer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, actually, think about it. How much like Spelljammer is? Is there even this phlogiston you go through to get to the crystal spheres between the different areas? Damn.
Yeah.
I'm making this connection right now, but this game is hella...
It wears it on its sleeve that it was attached to a tabletop game. It is very D&D in space.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Wasn't Ricky... our friend, wasn't he
Ritchie.
Like
that's what Ritchie. His Wikipedia Ritchie. Says.
Yeah.
Wasn't Ritchie part of TSR, or he wrote for D&D or something like that, or was that
he
Fred
did.
Ford?
No. Wait, was that Fred Ford? I don't remember.
He was a friend of Errol Otis, who was basically the guy who did all the core artwork for it. I'm looking here, and because I'm now curious, I went to his Wikipedia page, and it turns out he did write a whole bunch of old D&D world stuff. So yeah, Gamma World, which obviously has a lot of influence here, but then also Slave Pits of the Undercity, which was one of the big mega modules. This guy did a lot of RPG credits.
Like Sharky City kind of wears it all in his sleeve. I was actually watching an interview with Ars Technica with Ritchie and Ford, and they were saying how they were considering procedural generation for the planets, but they realized how that's not very special. Like, the way they put it is just procedural generation is very impressive at first, but then you kind of realize you don't have, as you said, Siobhan, the story behind each star. Like, it's very purposely placed, which they ended up doing for Star Control 2, saying, well, this one is close to the sun. It's like a ruby world. This one is, like, very hot. So they put, God, there's so many stars. When I think about what's coming up at Bethesda, Starfield, and how they're like, oh, yeah, there's 100 systems. And I just immediately thought about Star Control 2 and saying, holy crap, like, that's a lot of land to cover.
Yeah, it's just so insane to think about the fact that, I mean, at its core, this game is a space exploration game, but I think with the time limit that the game has, there's no way to actually explore every single star on a single playthrough.
No, take it from me. Yeah. There's not.
There's like no way. You never have enough fuel. And
if anybody like ever hasn't played this game and is interested in playing it, I recommend not playing it with a walkthrough and going into it with the mindset that like you are going to fail. Like your first three playthroughs, like eventually, you know, the Korra or whatever, their sphere is going to grow and start sweeping around the map.
And then you're just going to cry a whole lot.
And you're doomed. But you use that time to like keep a notebook and write down where everything is so you know where to go the next time around.
I was just about to say, this game demands a notebook and it demands you write down every coordinate anybody says. Because otherwise you're just going to be like...
Thing. If someone mentions a star system, you write that shit down because it is going to come into play later on.
Oh, yeah. It's anytime somebody is going to actually give you numbers, that means that's where you got to go. But Nadia, you know what? You haven't told us how you got into Star Control.
Oh, it started with a mental breakdown.
It's all good things, too.
It's all good things, too. Basically, in 2003, I was at a job as a janitorial job. Like I was I got really sick. I got tuberculosis. So I quit and kind of had a breakdown where I just couldn't really, you know, do anything for about a year. And around that time, of course, I had zero money. And of course, I was frequenting like, you know, thrift shops, seeing whatever cool stuff I could find. Back then, people still put video games in thrift shops. And I saw Star Control 2, like a box set for the PC. And I said, yeah, you know what? For some reason, I just recently heard of that. Sharky, it might have been something you wrote. I swear to God.
Probably. I was always going off about this.
And I said, okay, I'll grab that. And I grabbed it. And I'm like, oh, wow, this is actually really freaking awesome. And around the same time, I heard about Urquhart Masters, the remake that came out in 2000. And was it 2 when it came out, I think?
It was around then, yeah.
And I said, you know what? This is great on my good old 486, but I'm going to download the Urquhart Masters because, number one, it's free. Number two, it's the 3DO version of the game, which, although I had never played it, I remember seeing it in GameFan. When GameFan had a game that it loved and never shut up about it, so it had a whole thing about Star Control 2 for the 3DO. And I said, that looks like a really interesting game. I'm going to store that away for a future reference because God knows I'm never going to have a 3DO. And then when I heard, oh, they released this game that you were kind of interested in back when you were a kid, I said, okay, cool. I'm all down with this. And I went ahead and I downloaded it. And I'm like, oh, shit, this is a really freaking great game to have for free. Yeah. And I just like really fell into it. I fell into the lore because actually, thanks to having Star Control 2, the box set, I had the lore book and everything. So I was reading through that and putting everything together with Urquhart Masters. And then the game taught me a very hard lesson about how computer RPGs tend to be different from JRPGs on the console, which is I was, as you were saying, Shivam, like, you know, I was kind of goofing around in the stars. You don't really have time to do that, but I had no idea. And suddenly I noticed the Korra's sphere of influence is growing and growing.
Oh, yeah.
And everything in its shadow is decimated, just civilizations.
The first time you see that sphere grow, and then you see like the Umga just disappear, or like the Utwig just disappear, and you're like, what the hell just happened? Oh no! Oh no!
Oh shit, there goes the Kunk. I didn't like them, but they didn't deserve that.
And then you're like, oh, bad things have just happened.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm thinking, like, compared to console RPGs, I think, well, okay, Final Fantasy VII tells you the meteor is coming, but it's not going to drop ever. So I thought it was like that. But no, the Korra will.
No.
They'll literally kill everything in the universe. Yeah,
this game is basically like, yo, buddy, I am bringing the end times. Here they are. but it's really important to note just for a second that like Star Control 2, when it came out, it was like, you know, floppy disks, 1992, whatever, very basic traditional RPG. But this was one of the first real fan-based open source projects to come out, to become real popular, to get the blessings of the actual creators of the game. Like they basically took the original code, they open sourced it, they found the voice tracks and everything, they made it. They've updated even up till now, up till 2022. They've been continually updating this game to just work on new systems and to polish it more and more. And basically, they called it Urquhart Masters because Acclaim would not, or Accolade would not let them have the Star Control name, which has, you know, become a problem later with the other thing. But the fact that it existed for free, the full game, available for basically any system you want to play it on, and it's like 100% not like some, you know, hack version or nothing. This is the official full-on game. It's still impressive to me, and the fact that they did it in 2002 is just wild.
And it's even a version that you weren't likely to have played. I mean, who owned a 3DO? Like, I mean, I rented one once.
Your rich friend did.
It had some car game where the car looked like a shoebox. I don't remember anything else about it. But to have voice acting and everything adds so much to the game. There's so much character in just the art anyway, but to put these ridiculous voices on top of it. And the music ported over so well, just because they use mod trackers for it. And, you know, what was the story behind that? Didn't they hold like a contest?
They held a contest for mod composers.
So this was like demo scene people like on the Amiga doing this.
Yeah.
And with the samples in, you know, baked into the mod files like that, it just sounds really good on 3DO, and then it ports really well back to PC.
Yeah.
I still love that soundtrack. Fantastic.
It's one of my favorite soundtracks. Like I drive with that stupid hyperspace music sometimes.
it's both chill and also just invigorating. It makes you want to go out there and like triumph over the alien races out there. I mean, but the quasi space music is so good.
Oh, it's
the hyperspace music is so good. Like the only thing I don't like is the actual just battle music because you hear it so much.
Oh yeah,
but that's like a Final Fantasy Tactics problem, right? Like,
is interesting though. You can play through the game barely fighting, other than like a few obligatory fights near the end. Like you can get through most of it without firing a shot.
Yeah,
like, there are a few places where you're cornered into it, but you can almost do a pacifist run. You can play through it so many different ways. I mean, you can skip entire encounters and stuff too. Like you can play through the entire game and never talk to the Vux. Like other than General Zex, you don't have to mess with them at all.
Good old General.
Yeah, actually, that's wild to think about how this game allowed you to sequence break a lot. I'm surprised nobody tried to speedrun it, but probably just because it is very long. But I mean, people have speedrun friggin' like Elder Scrolls and Final Fantasy.
You can play through this in like an hour and a half if you're skipping the conversations. I'm sure somebody must have. It kind of defeats the purpose, though. You know, it's mostly just is the character and the talking to all these people that makes it fun. Like just watching somebody zip around, pick up the key items, and then go right to the end wouldn't be terribly entertaining.
That's true.
I don't know. I'm sure somebody will find some kind of glitch where you can just like teleport across and snatch everything.
At the quasi space, there's like hyper quasi space, and that's how they go through the game.
Fake space.
Okay, so Star Control 1, it comes out, Toys for Bob makes it in like 1990, put out on the Amiga and DOS. And like Sharky was saying, basically there was a story there. It was kind of thin. It was like about like alien races from the good guys fighting the alien races of the bad guys.
Yeah.
But the more important part is that they came with this game called Super Melee Mode, where every spaceship in the game was on this 2D screen. There's like a sun or a planet or something in the middle, and you're basically one half of you is using the arrow keys and like the shift and control button. The other half is using WASD and like spacebar and the other shift or something. And you're going back and forth and trying to just shoot each other. And each of your ships has like two weapons, like a main one and an alt one. You had a certain amount of life. And it literally played exactly like Space Wars did, as in the sun exuded gravity in the middle. You could swing around it. You could fly around. It's hella fun. It's one of like classic arcade experiences, and it still holds up.
I was always so terrible at the fighting. I tried to avoid it as much as possible. But I have heard the stories about people kind of playing the original with one keyboard. And there were some problems with like key binding back in the day. And so they actually, Toys for Bob released a fix for that, like a software fix, so that you could, two people could play at the same time without screwing up their keyboard. And there was the interview I was watching, there was a nice story about how one guy told them that his house had been wiped out in a hurricane and he was miserable, but he stayed with his friend and like playing Star Control, like just the combat just kept him kind of sane during a bad time. And they really liked that story, and I could understand why.
Yeah. I mean, Star Control 1 doesn't have a lot to sell for it, except that it exists. It feels a lot like a lot of the early like first games that you see on NESs, where like Mega Man 2 is the one you care about, Castlevania 2 is the one you care about, Zelda 2 is the one you care about, and nobody cares about the first games in those series. Yes, you heard me, don't at me. But StarCon 1 existed, and it gave us all the races, but the more important thing is that it gave us StarCon 2.
Yeah, that's kind of the thing, isn't it?
Yes. It's a fine prologue, but it's, yeah, exactly. It's not nearly as engaging. It is definitely just good guys and bad guys. And the moral ambiguity, if you would even call it that in Star Control 2, of like, there are two bad guys and you're rooting for one of them. It's the genociders versus the slavers, and you're rooting for the slavers.
Oh, I want to talk about that in depth, but we will get to that in 10 seconds. Because if I start now, it's gonna go. Yeah.
It's going to be the Urquan podcast. It's all we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so 1992 on DOS comes out StarCon 2. It's called Star Control 2, we know that. But when you went into DOS, the install folder was StarCon 2, /. So that's the way we call it, because we're old. StarCon 2, basically, it comes out, and the manual has this incredible storyline to fill in everybody who didn't play StarCon 1, which is like a lot of people. But you start off as this captain of this broken down precursor ship, which is basically the skeleton of a gigantic, like, Star Destroyer level ship thing. And you're off on this little planet that was forgotten by everybody, where like humans went and colonized and they're just hanging out. And you can later on go back to that planet and visit in the game, and your quantum locked it down. It sucks. But you go there and you come back to Earth, and you are limping into Earth with this busted spaceship. And the first thing you see is this little orb coming at you from the fact that, first off, the first thing you see is planet Earth is covered in a red shield. And you're like, what the hell is that? And there's a space station rotating around it. As you go towards the space station, a little probe comes out and it comes to you. And suddenly you get a message and you hear this, like, just horns blaring, and it's the most martial, terrifying noise you've ever heard in your life, of dun, 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 dun. And you're like, oh my God, what the hell? And there's gigantic, like, death centipede hanging down over this pit. And you're like, what the hell is going on? And he's got a little, like, you know, blob friend over there who starts talking to you. And he's like, we are the Urquan. And it's all this, like, horrifying, like,
and he's all blinking out of sync.
Oh yeah, his eyes are blinking, his body is twitching. And it's just like, you are flying an unauthorized vessel. We are going to kill you. So please hang out until we do. And you're like, what?
How am I telling you to wait? Don't, like, wait here or the punishment will be worse. How could it be worse?
Yeah, Mike, there's a giant scale.
For now, we're just going to kill you. If you keep this up, we're going to kill everybody.
Yeah, that's true. They do escalate.
Yeah. You go to the space station, and the captain there is like, get us some minerals and help us get some power and figure out what the hell's going on. So you do, it teaches you a basic mechanic of the game. You go to a planet, you send your lander down, hope it doesn't die, pick up fancy, like, purples and reds and yellows and, you know, rocks, sell them back to the dude. He gets his energy, you get to buy fuel, people, and ships, and, you know, you can go and explore the town. And while you're doing that and talking to this guy, suddenly out of nowhere, this spaceship comes hurtling out of space at you, which is limping. It's got half-life, and there's this crazy, terrifying Spider-Man.
The first thing I do is a spider.
Horrifying font, even, that looks like spider webs just kind of crawling across.
I noticed when I was going back over this that the first letter of every word of their sentence is capitalized.
Yeah. And and the thing is, the font choices in this game are so perfect for each race. They're really evocative, especially before they had voice acting, before they had anything. Like, you could look at it and be like, oh, this is, I don't want to mess with these people. The Illrath of all things. Illrath. Like,
yeah, well, they're the ones that are going to use the metalhead font.
Like, yeah, right.
Obviously, they're so edgelord.
They're so edgelord. And they've got, like, the Klingon ships, and they got cloaking devices. And first off, when you get into battle with this guy and he just goes invisible and you're like, what, where the hell did he go? And then comes out of nowhere next to you shooting fire. And you're like, okay, this is messed up and I hate this. Please don't kill me. Cause you got the dinky human ship, which is like a clunky ass, like, garbage ship that shoots out nuclear bombs and little lasers. And it's trash.
It is just the space warship.
Yeah. It's literally all there just is a space warship.
I think you can get FWIFO before that point.
You can definitely get FWIFO.
Best character in the game.
Absolutely.
He's like the only ship I keep for the entire game.
He's great.
You have to. I mean, it's the law.
It's like, the best ship.
So when you come into Sol for the first time, you're in our planetary system. Pluto is out there and it's close to you and you can go pop over. When you go to Pluto, you find two things. One is there's a one lone purple, like, resource there, which is great. It gives you money for starting. And two, there's a random weird looking ship that's a whole bunch of balls kind of just stuck it's around like the central
toys.
Ball. Yeah, so it looks like a Tinker toy or like a chemistry set where you're modeling some atom that nobody's ever heard of. Like, you know, the ones where you have to foam ball and stick like the gumdrops into it like you did in high school. And you get there and there's this weird mollusk squid man who's just like, please don't kill me. I'm the only one. Or he starts with, I will destroy you. and I am super brave, and I'm definitely not the only one on this ship here. For
yeah,
real.
Yeah, and he does something like, he says something to the effect of, okay, well, I know you're just going to torture me, so why bother? Here's these coordinates of my home. Here's everything you want to know. But yeah. First thing he says to you.
It's so, Fwifo, I love him so much. First off, Fwifo, what a name.
What a name. What a name. Swiffer.
By way of introduction, he just sells out his entire species.
Yeah. Perfect. And he tells you about his life and how he had like, you know, something like 8,000 brothers and sisters, and he was thrilled because his mom called him by name once.
Yeah, it's like the
spathi. Hours and hours of conversation if you want to listen to it.
Oh, God. And they talk for it. They wrote so much. And when you think about this now, think about how much audio is in this game since every bit of dialogue gets read out in the 3DO version. Like 2/3 of that CD must have just been like voice tracks.
Easy. Yeah, and for sure.
So Fwifo is in this spathi eluder, I think they called it.
Yeah.
And it's awesome because it's got this thing called the butt missile, where it's like its main weapon is this little pea shooter that shoots out like a little ways and nobody cares about. But the alt weapon is this purple missile that comes out your butt, basically, because you're meant to be running away and just shooting these guys. And it's got a little fart noise. That comes
it does.
Out.
It makes a little fart noise when it makes the when it shoots. And it's perfect. It's the only ship I can think of that is not built for like suicide head on missions.
Oh, yeah. No, this thing is all about just.
It's a great matchup against almost everything.
Yeah.
Like, you can just run away the entire match. It takes forever.
You kite people.
Yeah.
You kite them and you just fart at them. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, and they don't even show up in the game, but the Android synth have like the opposite of that, where you just basically like blaze through people.
Oh yeah, dude, I love the Android synth.
I've never tried their ship. I just know about them and how they are no more. Because
yeah,
they
don't ask,
ask
about
questions.
That. Keep asking. No, yeah, too much asking. We are dancing. Like,
one of my favorite races ever, and the fact that they basically are just like completely obliterated in this is like it's so sad. But their ships are cool. They turn into like giant flaming comets that just kind of blaze through you. But yeah, so StarCon 2, it was amazing. It was incredibly long. And I think that in order to stop you from basically spending the next forever going through every star, the designers set this game up to be a colossal war between two races. And if you take too long, which is like longer than 5 years of in-game time, one of the races wins. And then they start just going through and obliterating. Should we talk about the Urquan right now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we're going to talk about the Urquan.
We have to. We might as well. They're the centipede in the room, right? So,
yeah, you.
The premise of this story is that Earth has been captured. Earth and all of the good races from StarCon 1 were captured and enslaved by this race of centipede dudes called the Urquan. Obviously, the Urquan Masters in the title of the game. They're these green centipedes that hang down. They're too cool to talk to you, so they use these little brain slugs called denarii that they use to actually communicate with you. And these guys are like hyper-fascists. When they have their big, giant green ships, they shoot out their crew at you, which then go and zap you little by little and then suck them back in. And their whole gimmick is, we want to go through the universe and enslave all the races and lock you into your own planet, to either turn you into a combat race that works for us or turn you into a slave race and just put you on your planet and leave you alone. Mm. And they have been doing this thing called the Path of Now and Forever, which is they're part of this big, giant collective race of Urquan. And the other half of the Urquan race, the horrifying, horrifying Korra, yeah. Who are the black centipede guys who've got like these ships that shoot out metal blades and have flame like circles around them and hang over a pit of bones. They basically decided that, no, we're going to go through the race, go through the universe and kill every sentient being we
find. Eternal doctrine. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So these two races, the Urquan Korra, who are the black ones, the Urquan Kazurza, the green ones, basically meet up and they're like, you know what? If we hang out, we're going to destroy each other. So I'm going to go this way and you're going to go that way. And the next time we meet up, we're going to have a big battle and whoever wins gets to obliterate the universe or something. Well, it turns out your system is the lucky one where they decided to meet up your little quadrant of the corner of the universe. So you're there and the Urquan are obviously the big bad guys from the first game. They're the big bad guys now. And you're like, who's going on? What's this evil stuff? But the story, when you like talk to the Korra, and like the other races, and you find out the way to actually talk to these people, and you're like, why are you like this? No, halt. What you are doing is wrong.
Why do you,
know,
do this
why
are you
do
doing
something?
This thing? Yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, well, let me tell you.
Here's buddy. My entire backstory.
Yeah. And it's like one of the most messed up things ever, right? Like these guys used to be a brown race of peace-loving centipedes who were kind of violent when they're mating, but otherwise whatever. And this race of denarii, the little brain slugs that they turned into their talkers, controlled them and turned them into slaves, bred them to split them into combat half and scientist half, and then use these necklaces to control them called the Excruciators.
Which oh, no, they use those to escape their control.
Oh, yeah.
Because they can't control them when they're in pain, so they subject themselves to pain.
These guys are basically mind-controlled, and they were getting zapped, and they were getting messed up. And then Kazerzah, one of the scientists, creates this thing called an Excruciator, which basically causes them to be in so much pain that the Denari have to break the telepathic link because they're just like, ow, this hurts. And so these guys basically have to, like, torture themselves in order to free their race and then, like, just go ham on everything. And I'm like, huh, a race where you literally have to just fry yourself in order to free yourself probably is not going to leave for a good bunch of people to hang out with.
No, they're pretty pissed off.
I do like their revenge, though, is if, considering that they're, you know, they're very territorial and they hate talking to other species. They have like this instinctive revulsion of being around them. So like the most insulting thing they can think of for their worst enemy is to turn them into translators. Like,
yeah, basically.
As punishment, you have to talk to aliens. On my behalf.
Yeah, and like you don't get to have freedom. You are literally just a babel fish that sits in the corner. And I'm like, that's pretty rad.
Video Death Loop is the show where we watch a short video clip on loop until we just can't take it anymore. Along the way, we'll try our best to make each other laugh and to hold out longer than the other guy. Come in on any episode. Video Death Loop, new episodes every Friday.
As a fan of podcasts, you've probably thought about starting one of your own. Introducing the new HyperX Duocast. The Duocast has all the essential features an aspiring podcaster would want from a USB mic, with HyperX favorites like Tap to Mute and a vibrant mute indicator. It's compact and elegantly styled, perfect for situations where you want a mic that looks great but isn't too extra. Check out the new HyperX Duocast, available at Target.com or shop direct at HyperX.com.
Video Death Loop is a show where we watch a short clip on loop until one or both of us can't take it anymore. Each week, one of us picks out a video the other does not know about to their dismay. Video game cutscenes, TV show openings, music videos, and occasional horse videos are just some of the clips we've ran, and we're 5 seasons in. Check us out every Friday.
But yeah, so, Starcon, I'm sorry. Sorry, Nadia, I took over.
No, I mean, that's why I had this podcast. I know you two would be the ones to, like, really, well, you've been wanting to do this for ages, so have I. So I totally understand. Like, just like, holy shit, this is a diamond place.
Oh my God, dude. I've been playing this game again recently. And when you go, so I guess we should lay out what the game is, right? So basically, you're out there. You've got your ship. You can buy other ships from the races that ally with you. So the Spathi, the humans, the Punk, the Yeehat, whatever. And each of them acts in a different way. You go around to different planets. You meet the various races. When you meet them on the star map, a big bubble pops up to show you the sphere of influence that they have, which is really cool storytelling because sometimes they'll be like, you meet these race of hippie birds called the Pecans, who are super fun, super famous. They've got this little butterfly ship that spins around. They can resurrect themselves. They're my personal favorite race.
Yeah, when they resurrect, goes, hallelujah, it's great.
But I was playing this the other night. Like, I've won that coin flip like 6 times in a row.
It feels so good. It feels so good when you do. Because you just have to jam on the attack buttons and hope that you get it. Or at least that's what we told ourselves.
It makes for the most absurd final fight in the game, though. Because, I mean, you really have to rely on them. And the entire time, you're just shouting insults. Because that's how they recharge their guns, so you're just flying around going, jerk, wimp, loser, dweeb.
I forgot about that.
So the Pecans have a little butterfly ship, and it's got these cool little 3 like shooters that come out, whatever. But when you fire, you've got energy, and your energy gets re-energized either by waiting, or in the case of like the Pecans, you have to use your alt to refill your energy. And their alt is literally just yelling schoolyard insults at people, and you're fighting against these death centipedes going.
This is the final battle, weenie. Too. Like,
so you're like up against like the black horrible centipedes and these like Toucan Sam motherfuckers, like,
yeah. Dweeb.
Dweeb.
Jerk. But yeah, so then there's a race of these, like, you know, bird guys who are pterodactyls called the Yeehawt, who are basically like these crazy martial samurai.
Yeah,
yeah, the Scottish dudes. And they sit there, and the Yeehawt and Pekunk were apparently a long ago one race, and they split up, and over the course of the story, you cause them to fuse together, and you see slowly the Pekunk sphere of influence moving closer and closer, and then just disappearing into the Yeehawt.
Oh, yeah, like, before that, like, when you start their civil war, like, the Yeehawt splits into two spheres of influence when they start fighting each other. I mean, like, watching those move around, like, and you can actually, like, stall the game a little bit. Like, you can prolong, like, your deadline.
Yes.
Like, you can trick the Thridash into fighting the Iroquois, and that'll slow it down a little bit. Or the Supox and the, whatever, the depressive guys.
The
Udwig.
Udwig,
like,
yeah.
They'll go over there, and it'll give you a few more months while they just, you know, die futilely.
it's got so much personality, this game does. It's like oozes ridiculous. I mean, every single race is unique. Every single ship is unique. Like, one of my favorite is the hyper-capitalist Drudge.
Oh, the Drudge?
Oh, God, they're
DNA.
A little on the nose, yeah.
Yeah, like, first off, their dude is, like, hanging from chains over this, like, factory, and you can go there because you have to buy some items from them, and you can sell your crew members to them to get credits to buy things from, or to buy fuel or whatever. And then your people are like, did you just sell our people into slavery? It's like, no.
Oh, yeah. The price for crew goes way up if you do that. Everybody's like, oh, my God, this asshole's going to sell us to these guys. And they fuel their ships by throwing their crew in the furnace. It's like Amazon.
Exactly. And you see, like, the little icon of the hand pick up a thing and just throw it into the fire pit. And you're like, oh, no. Oh, no.
Screams, if I'm not mistaken. You hear screaming.
Oh, yeah. It's horrifying. And then, like, the samurai Shafixtai, who got their, like, you know, one dude left, and his ship has a bomb on it that will explode. So you have to go into combat with the guy and then escape a whole bunch, because otherwise he will kill himself and you will lose. And it's like, oh, no, what am I doing?
There are so many, like, just the screen goes white and you're dead, and it goes back to the title. Like, when you find the Utwig bomb, like, you can just use it.
Yeah, and it's like, oh.
I found this, let's set it off. Oh, that's what happens. Okay,
or you bring it back to the station, and the guy is just like, yeah, just go somewhere else with that.
Yeah, please never do that again.
At the end of the stand, when Trash Can Man's hauling back the nuke to Flag, and Flag like, get that out of here, please.
Yeah, like,
of course, the little marsupial guys are, like, just borderline racist, though. Like, of course they have, like, a Harry-Carry device.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
But you have to, like, find the pervert Vux guy to like, get the emails,
right,
and then he, like, replenishes the race in, like, a month.
Well, they are like, you know, little marsupials. They do spawn like bunnies. But
that's how you get cheaper. That's how you get cheaper crew.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. The crew cost goes down to one after that.
Yeah. Because everybody just now you've got a bunch of rats in your team.
Everyone's a rat.
You're just up to your waist in tribbles, basically. Like murderous Japanese tribbles.
Yeah. I love that the Vux were these ugly one-eyed, like, traditional aliens. The pervert among them is the one who wants to talk to humans, and he's like, oh, I love humans, they're so cool. And I'm like, oh, you're real creepy, bro.
Yeah, you got tentacles, dude.
That's one of those ones too, like, you can go down the conversation tree with the Vux, and eventually they'll admit that, like, you know, it wasn't because of this insult during first contact, we just think you're really fucking gross. Like, we can't stand the way your necks move and the bones in your mouth,
like, and, like, two eyes, it's so disgusting. And then, of course, my personal favorite, the Eralu, who are traditional, like, you know, bald-headed little green men with the UFO spaceships who are, like, living in quasi-space. And their ships have no inertia, which is completely wild when you try to play with them in, like, combat. Like, oh, they can just stop. Every other ship gets dragged by gravity or by, you know, when they move according to thrust and propulsion, which is half of the fun of the combat system. It's, like, so tricky to get your thing to go where you want.
For sure.
But I love the Eralu can both teleport and literally turn on a dime.
I like how everybody's reaction to the Eralu is just sort of vague unease. Like, they've been nothing but helpful. Like, they were useful in the previous war. They've done everything they could for you, but everybody's like, those creepy little bastards.
They modified our genetics 10,000 years ago.
I mean, they were probing our butts, probably. I mean, that's implied.
They kind of admit that they've been like, you know, oh, yeah, sometimes we let you remember when we examined you. And they have so much under, like, they – they treat you very condescendingly, like a child, but not in a really mean way.
Every time they're like, "Oh, you're so clever, you baby!
Oh, you're so like you're a cat that learned how to use the toilet." Like that's just how they talk. But what really intrigues me about the Arilu is they kind of tie into the Lovecraftian element of Star Control 2, which is absolutely excellent. To me, it's like the best video game version of Lovecraft.
It's such a hinted at story that they don't really, you know, they don't blow it up.
Yeah.
You're allowed to infer this. Like, you know, the Arilu do talk a little about it. Like, they were probably trying to protect you from the Oars, but they don't outright say it.
Yeah, I love that, like, the way that they've got space set up is like quasi-space is above. The Oars are from below. And you're like, oh, that's bad.
And also the implication that they're all just like one being.
Yes.
Like, oh, you're many bubbles. We're not many bubbles. We are fingers. Okay, whatever. That's
terrifying
means.
And terrifying. Stupid at the same time.
Meanwhile, they look like parrotfish.
Yeah, so let's talk about the Oars for a second, which I used to always laugh at because, like, when I was going on the internet and I met a bunch of Koreans and they would use the old, like, bow emoji, which was O-R-Z.
I always thought they're saying Oars.
Every time I see the Oars, I'm just like, ah, the juice is boiling. And I'm like, no, they're bowing at me. I don't get it. But, yeah, so the Oars. The Oars are these little parrotfish thing that live on this planet, and they're like, welcome to the party. And you're like, what?
Because are you happy campers?
Yeah, like, are you happy campers? They are from a place that your translation cannot handle. So when it can't, it fills in random words. And the way it is with these dudes is like their voices are normal and then it goes way weird. Which is why, like, at the top of the show, I made sure that Nadia said the greatest quote of all, which is when the Oars get pissed at you and they're like, the juice is boiling. And you're like, oh, no, don't boil the juice. I don't want to know what that is, but don't boil the juice.
And the only thing that pisses them off, though, is asking them about the Androsynth. You're never going to get that story because the implication is that they are, like, they replaced them.
Oh, yeah. No, what basically the idea – so in StarCon 1, the humans have created a race of, like, fully, replicants. Like, sentient cyber – like, yeah, right. You know, cyber beings, whatever, like, clones, things. And they call them the Androsynth, which is one of my favorite, like, just space alien names ever.
Yeah, I love
but,
it.
But, yeah, so the Androsynth are this cool race, and they're like, you know, screw humans. We're going to go off and live on our own. We're going to make our own planet. It'll be great.
Blackjack and hookers, yeah.
Yeah, and they go and do that. And you lose contact with them. Earth loses contact with them. Civilization loses contact with them. And like, what happened to the Anderson? Let's go find out. And we go there and there's these random fish there. And we're like, hello, we're here now. And you're like, can we talk to the Anderson? No.
And don't ask about it.
Stop asking.
Yeah.
Too much asking and we are dancing.
As the way the Arilu put it is the most chilling. There are no more Anderson, only Oars.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just so sad. And it's because, like, their story is so, like, they made it. They got free. No, they got sucked into the nether.
And that actually terrified me.
Oh, God.
Because when I'm reading about the Andersons and how rightfully pissed off they are about humans, and then you're warned, okay, you're going to have to go into Anderson space. I'm like, oh, here we go. And I find these. There are ruins on the homeworld of the Andersynth, and I can't remember if that's where one of the guys who sees the ruins or something in the ruins has flashbacks or he has hallucinations about a sequence that was based on a very specific Lovecraft story where a guy could see things, you know, quote unquote, beyond the veil. And he could see like these enormous jellyfish monsters that, you know, that the rest of his companions couldn't see. So it was kind of based on that where this guy is seeing these things and is actually what the Androsynth warned humans about. If you can see them, they can see you, and we don't want that. So that's why they really don't want you to F around in that quadrant of space.
Yeah, anybody who's even a little bit psychic, like, has terrible visions and that sort of thing. And the implication is that, like, the Arilu were modifying us to not be psychic, so we didn't have to deal with this.
Yeah.
It's classic Silver Age sci-fi stuff, you know? I used to love how, like, telepathic powers were just a given in like, golden Silver Age sci-fi.
Right.
Like, even old episodes of Star Trek or whatever, people have, like, their Esper rating is on their personnel file.
Oh, man. You know what? That's exactly... Good point, Sharky. This is exactly that. This is, like, every good 1950s sci-fi pulp trope wrapped into one.
Well, even the art for the aliens is very inspired by like pulp sci-fi.
100%.
Oh, absolutely.
If you took the Arilu splash screen and put it on the cover of a 50s book and say, they walk among us, yeah, I'd believe it.
Or you could take like the Sirene or whatever.
I was like, just about to say.
Practically Frank Frazetta, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like the Sirene, a whole race of space Amazons that are all women that just happen to be able to mate with humans, well, including you, Captain.
They're blue or green or whatever.
Yeah, they're blue space girls. Uh-huh. Captain Kirk.
Apparently
okay.
They keep their lungs in their boobs because every time they breathe in, their tits inflate. It's such a weird animation.
What an adaptation. My goodness. And nature is incredible.
Look, I'm not going to say that Ford and Richie were exactly mature people here, especially when you think the Sirene spaceship.
All the Leisure Suit Larry ass replies you can make to them, too. Like, every one of them is like a sleazy pickup line.
I know.
Oh, well, I mean, you have a friggin' sex scene, which is absolutely voiced hilariously comically.
And oh, God. Also, yeah, I won't even spoil that. Also, their ships are called the Penetrator.
The Penetrators.
Like a dildo. Like, it's not subtle. It's definitely like 14-year-old kind of sense of humor.
Look, when I was 14 and playing this game, it was rad. Okay? It was rad.
You are the target audience.
Yeah, I was.
Still am.
Yes, the Sirene Penetrator, which has a particle beam stiletto at the front and hypnotization field projection ribs, presumably for her pleasure.
For your pleasure.
I love that mechanic, too, though. It's like just steal and sell other people's crew using the Sirene and then, like, just have them jump out of their ships because they're so eager to meet the green ladies.
Oh, yeah, dude, that's the thing. Their alt power is like, it's like a siren. Summoned you to come out, but they're...
Do they have their space suits when they do that, or do they just die in the vacuum space?
I mean, you can pick them up and they become your crew.
Oh, okay. That's cool.
Yeah, you can actually like farm enemies' crew that way. It's a dumb thing to do, but you can.
So my trick was I would go there and I would use a Sirene Penetrator to soften them up by sucking away their crew and then escape with it and then bring in an actual ship to win with. But like, for instance, the official Ultronomicon Wikipedia for the Penetrator says, along with the Mycon podship and Conk Fury, the Penetrator is one of the few ships able to come out of battle stronger than it went in. I'm like, that's a saying there.
Yeah, that's coming. Nice.
The ship's phallic resemblance, coupled with the fact that it's piloted by a matriarchal race, may lend to its euphemistic name. No kidding, Wikipedia. No kidding.
You don't say.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the Sirene. And, of course, the Sirene have to deal with the Mycon, who are these, like, mushroom people that have these cool little red spaceships, and you go there and try to get one of their eggs to
it's a backstory. It's a whole story. But they also have a thing, like if you go deep into the conversation trees, you can start to like parse out what their deal is, you know, because they'll like speak these random bits of dialogue that are implied to be like their ancestors at different points in the past.
Yeah.
And you can kind of piece it together that they're, you know, they're not really a naturally occurring species. They're a terraforming tool that somebody forgot about.
Exactly. Isn't that such a cool idea?
Yeah. It's just exactly.
Classic sci-fi tropes. I love these things.
Just all the... I just love how everyone's linked together in some way.
Yes.
Yeah, there aren't really anything that exists in isolation, no, other than like the Zokfot pick.
Frungi.
Which one of you is the Fot?
That's a great line.
You're the Fot. No, you're the Fot. Meanwhile, like probably the Fot is just sitting in the background not talking.
Dude, the Zokfot pick suck, but they're so funny. And like,
oh, they're trash.
They're
hilarious.
The dialogues in this game are well written. And the poor Zabranki, who were once the fourth one of the Zokfot pick, but they had to destroy them. Okay, so the Spathi, I got to say though, so like the Spathi are sitting there, and when you go and try to get them to join you, the Spathi king and queen are like, no, we're terrified. We don't want to go anywhere, and we can't leave because our planet is covered in these giant, scary monsters. And they're like, okay, fine, we'll kill them. You go down to that planet and they're just stuffed.
Immobile. There's like koalas. They're just like dumb little primates. They don't even attack you.
Yeah, they're just teddy bears. They sit there
and blink at you.
These people are just pathetic. Absolutely.
And they join you for like a week, just long enough to study your slave shield so they can put one over their own planet because that's all they ever wanted.
Yeah, they're like, bye.
And they wanted to be a follow species. They wanted to be on the slave shield. But what was the Umga?
The Umga,
real assholes. Ruined that for them.
So the Umga are basically colossal tricksters and also like big brain, right? Like, so they sit there and they're genetically modified mutators. So another sci-fi trope. And they help you out by like, we found this random translator from a fallen Urquan ship. And they're like, oh, so we fixed it. and we made it back to the way it was. And suddenly this Denari wakes up and it's like a full on telepath that's just like mind controlling
takes
you
over the entire civilization, yeah, like overnight.
Everything is terrible. And you're like, yeah, oh, that was bad.
That was a bad idea.
But they're also grateful for like a week. And then they're like, you know what would be funnier? If you were our great enemy. And then they just fight you for no reason. They're just trolls. they're like Space 4chan.
Let's talk about the Cilandro for a second.
Oh,
the
God.
Cilandro are basically the most annoying random encounter in this game.
Oh, and they become more and more frequent as the game goes on, unless you deal with
them. Yeah, they reproduce.
Like, these guys just come out there, and there's these crazy, like, lightning rod kind of spaceships, these crystalline beings. They shoot you and zap you with these big electric things, and they get their energy back by absorbing from, like, passing by asteroids. And when you kill them, you get 500 credits, which is basically the only value they have, is just killing them. Yeah.
But when you talk to them, they're always like, we come in peace. We're here to study or whatever. And even their background music is just a loop of them saying, we come in peace.
Yeah,
and it sounds
terrifying.
All screwed up because their programming screwed up.
Yeah, exactly.
They're a runaway von Neumann probe. Somebody screwed their priorities. Again, classic trope.
Classic trope, because you go there and they're like, wait, their homeworld's a gas giant and there's these bunch of just floating sparkle things? What the heck is this? It's like, oh, you found our probes? They're out there to get resources and bring them back to us. Aren't they neat? And you're like, no, they're destroying
no,
the
they're
universe.
Killing
like,
everyone.
And like, what do you
oh,
mean?
No.
They're peaceful and they just kind of take asteroid and like, no, they're disintegrating universes. And you're like, oh, let's just look at the programming here. Oh, we set aggression to 99999? That seems like a problem.
Somebody switched this thing to evil. There's your problem. Wonder how many people kind of gave up early on the game because those probes, if you don't know what you're doing, and
they're too hard for the early game. They're
hard,
and that's a deliberate choice. I like that. That's even part of the backstory. Is like, you know, the captain of the ship that you have with you, the only Earth ship you've got, like was killed in an encounter with one of those. But they don't tell you
what
it was. You know, it's just that we encountered this thing and it did this, but we don't know what it is or what its origin is. But it's baked into the backstory too.
Oh, I forgot about that. Yeah, he was killed by like the jabroni, the space debris. Well, like, just,
I can't really cap his name, but I think it was implied that your character like had a crush on her or something. I don't know.
Of course you did. Well, that opening novel in the friggin' manual sets up a whole lot of story that the game kind of just lets it exist. But StarCon 2, every race in there is just this absolute vibrant. Every one of them's got a deep backstory. Like, there's these traders you meet, these one-eyed dudes called the Melnorme.
Who
are just these big guys show up out of nowhere. And they're like, we want these plants and animals that you've been picking up. And in return, we'll give you better tech. And we'll also tell you stories about things. And when you learn about, like, the history of, like, the sentient milieu and the various
races.
They're
the ones that teach you the words to get the Urquan to info dump.
The info dump words.
And this is one of those few games where I am here for every written word. Like,
sure.
I want to know every info you're going to dump at me. They're so good.
And even then, it leaves you like stuff to piece together yourself. Like, they never outright state that they're the male numb from the sentient milieu that got away.
Right?
But they almost certainly are. I mean, that's the implication. It's just, but it's there for you to, you know, pluck that out if you want to listen.
This game goes out of its way to make you feel intelligent for putting things together.
Right. That's a good point.
Like,
that's a good way to put it.
You find the rainbow world, you're going to different worlds, you're putting these puzzles together, you figure out that in this one quadrant of space, on the 17th day of every month, a portal opens that lets you go to green space. You're like, what the hell is going on? It's so good.
Even the rainbow worlds, they make, if you put them together, they make an arrow.
An arrow that points toward the center of the galaxy, and they kind of
points towards where their precursors probably went.
Yeah, that's the implication. And they've poorly followed up on that in the third game that doesn't exist.
Oh, did they now?
Yeah.
You know, I played a lot of StarCon 3, but we'll talk about that in a minute. So who are your favorite races? We've talked about a bunch of them, but there's so many races in this game.
I mean, obviously, you're going to have to like take the Urquan out of the running because that's, you know, the most well-developed and the most interesting.
I was probably going to say Urquan, especially the Korra, because actually the voice acting in the game, even though it can be very cheesy at times, like the Korra are so bang on chilling that
they
are just
so terrifying.
It's great.
The way they talk to you, you know how sometimes you go up against a villain, you're like, oh, I can probably manipulate this guy if I want to. He seems like a bit of a jerk or whatever. These guys, no, you just get the implication that there is no negotiation. There is nothing but death. And just this, the one word answers they give you. And there's one answer in particular, if you try to say, hey, calm down, dude, let's be friends. He's like, something like, many civilizations have sent their wise men to find out a way to calm us down. All of them have failed.
No, it's just this is just their job. It's like arguing with a bug. You can't.
Yeah, and their ships are horrifying. Their combat mechanics are horrifying, and they just go and mess you. Like when you wait too long, and you like start to hear about them from like other races showing up, and they're like, "Yeah, man, that planet we went to was just coated in these metal giant metal blades that just jacked everything up." And you're like, "Oh no, what is going on?"
Well, they serve as such a perfect foil for the Urquan, though. It's like the only thing that could make them look good in comparison.
Right? Like, what makes a fascist look good? Oh, the murderers. Okay. Yeah.
I don't know. Would you describe them as the Urquan anyway, not the Kor-A, as sympathetic villains? I mean, as victims of abuse. I mean, to put it lightly.
Yeah, like, exactly. Right. Like
this they make a very good case for themselves. I mean,
the Urquan Khazar-Zaa just need a therapist real bad on a racial level.
a big god sized therapist. But no, yeah. You got a point there, Sharky, because I opened that myself when I discovered the twist, if you want to call it that, and the reason why they're putting everyone under a slave shield. I said, holy shit, that's really something right there. And even I don't want to say they're good, because they certainly are not. Like, no. They will kill you if you cross them. But they did things like when the Sirens said, well, you can't enslave us. We don't have a home planet anymore, because it got Juffa-whooped, or whatever the term was. They're like, oh, okay, well, here's a new planet. Oh, it's exactly what
it's
we need.
It's a paradise. Okay. And it's like, yeah.
It's a paradise. Thanks,
they solve a lot of problems. And they do make the case for themselves when they say that, like, you know, we've come across so many dead worlds where they either nuked themselves into oblivion or ecology collapsed. And it's like, if we had been there sooner, they'd probably still be alive.
Yeah.
No, for sure.
They're like, look, we are doing this for your benefit. Yeah, you don't get freedom and you can't go anywhere. However, you get to survive. That's great, right? And like, the thing, it's funny, when you talk to them about the Kor-A, they almost become like, you seriously, no, you don't want any part of that. Trust me, what we're offering, even though it's bad, and we understand it's not great, is still better than complete and utter oblivion. Trust me, the Kor-A will just vaporize you. And it's almost like they get a sense of pleading in their voice, almost like, please, please don't go there. Please don't mess with them. Mm-hmm. You can't. My personal favorite race is the Chmur, which in the first game, there were two races. One was the hypermechanical Murnimurm, which looked looked like they walked out of like a, you know, War of the Worlds type of thing. They're just these giant columns of like alien things. And then
their ship is a literal transformer.
Yeah, right?
It is.
And then, like, the Chinjessu, who are basically these sentient, like, crystal beings. And when the Urquan come and enslave everybody, they say, hey, can you just put us on the planet with the Murnimurm? And so these two races get together, and you bring them a giant sun device that lets them fuse and create this crazy, like, cybernetic crystal being called Chmur. And it's this they're basically, like, the leader race, like, mm-hmm. If you're Doug, they're the guy who's the school president in Doug, which is a 1992 reference. Because I'm just thinking about that one episode where, like, Doug accidentally gets the keys to the squash room and has to be in charge. And he's like, no, I'm not supposed to be. The Chmur are the ones who are supposed to be in charge of your federation. You're just the chump who's there. So when they come out of this thing, they create this ship, which looks like the coolest. If you were 12, you design a spaceship ship you could ever design.
Oh, yeah. You totally drew this in your Trapper Keeper in eighth grade.
Right? Like, it's this awesome looking
the spaceship you make out of Lego.
Right, yeah, exactly that. It is exactly that. And it's got these three things that are hovering around it. It's such a sick ship.
It's got, like, point defense lasers, and it's one of the best ones to take into the end.
Isn't, like, part of the story is that the Chmur needed, like, they were trying to merge to fight back against the Urquan, but they would have needed, like, thousands of years to complete the process.
It would have taken 35 years as powered by their sun, but they were like, look, we need to go faster than that. So we have the precursor sun device.
Right.
Boom.
And they even say, like, this isn't the result we wanted. Like, because we rushed it, like, we haven't reached the potential we could have had, but, you know, we're here now.
Yeah, they're like, look, buddy, but since we're here, let me help you.
Exactly. Well, here I am. Let's do this thing. I actually, as someone who is a huge nerd also for Master of Orion, I always thought like that there was a connection for sure with the Myrnimer and the Mekon and the Silicons and the other race. Like I always thought that there was like a connection there.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely feels like it.
Is there callbacks to a lot of old sci-fi tropes, like a lot of things here? It's one of those things where I'm always tempted to say, like, how much did Mass Effect ripped off from this thing? And it's like, well, they're ripping off the same sources. I mean, obviously this was an influence. Yeah,
they're all coming from the same puddle.
Oh, for sure. I mean, BioWare has admitted that Star Control's a huge, huge influence for Mass Effect.
I mean, right down to the crappy little dune buggy. Far and away the worst part of that game.
No, for sure. But like the when I first heard about Mass Effect and I heard about the Krogan, I said, "Oh shit, that's the Thradish."
Oh, that's the Thradish. Yeah, totally. Like just nuking themselves back into oblivion like every few centuries.
Yeah.
But I love the Thradish though. You see them and they're these big dudes with these stogies. There's these warthog dudes and their ship's got this awesome like fire coming out the backside and they're just like this crazy
just this
psycho.
The most 90s try hard cool guy.
Oh yeah,
and there are multiple ways of dealing with them too. Like,
I love it.
You're not like railroaded into any one thing. Like you can just keep kicking their ass until they start deciding, like, oh, well, you must know what you're doing. We're going to model our civilization after you guys since you beat the shit out of us. Or you can trick the Edgelord Spider guys into killing them.
Like, right,
that's right.
Like,
yeah,
I think so. You get this thing called like the Umga Caster, which lets you talk to different races periodically, and like the Ilroth, when you go to their space and you figure out the radio station that they use to get messages from their gods.
Talk to their gods.
So you pretend to be their gods, and you're like, you are now called the Dilrats, and you're like, well, I guess you said so. God,
that's it.
We're now the Dilrats, and you can use it to send messages to them saying you should go to this planet and fight against these guys there, and you send it to Thrad. Space and the Thradish are like, yeah, these dudes came and we get to kill them and it's awesome. And I love it because you can either send the Thradish to fight the Korah and slow things down or to just handle the Ilroth and just...
Well, you can do both. You can send the Thradish to fight the Urquan and then you can send the Dilrats to kill them.
God, it's so much fun.
I love the idea of the Urquans having those like really serious battle between them, and then like these space rhinos and space spiders come up, and they're like, "What the hell?"
And then like some plant guys, why is that flower here?
Yeah.
I like when you talk to them too. Like you can even say like our top scientists and sci-fi writers have said that intelligent plants are impossible, and it's like, oh, ours do too. That's why we're pretty sure we're divine.
That's a good comeback, actually.
Ah, yes, the Supoks. They're so weird. Like, I never used their ships. They were just there.
Oh, they suck. Was,
yeah, they're on the far side of the planet. It's fine. The Utwig, though, I love their ships. They had a shield. They were slow as hell, but they had, like, a really good range weapon. It's just that they were so sad and emo and wore a, like, veil all the time. Their music is just like, hello, Captain.
I'm just feeling really down right now.
It's like me during quarantine.
Oh man, they were ahead of their time then.
Yeah, they're like, look, Susie Sue is on the radio. Can we talk? Oh, man. Okay, but yeah, so every race in this show, in this game, is amazing. Absolutely amazing. And you basically go through the universe, fly around, find ways to make your hyperspace travel faster, find ways to make your quasi-space travel faster. One of my favorite ones is, like, I pop out of quasi-space, and I end up in the middle of, like, Korah space.
Oh, good.
And you're in the middle of Korah and Urquan space, and you're like, oh,
oops,
this is bad. I need to leave yesterday. And it's wild, though, because like, you can see the Urquan, the two Urquan races having battles with each other, and you go to a planet, and there's like six of them, and they're just like, oh, you know, why don't you guys solve this amongst yourselves, and I will never come back.
I do love how the battle between the Urquans really does feel like something way above you, something that like your little ape mind shouldn't even be comprehending, because it's basically a battle of something ascending gods.
Oh, it's like a classic, like, Babylon 5, like, war in heaven kind of things. Like, these are the elders, and we are just the kids, like, living in the backyard.
Yeah, it's definitely Mama and Daddy are fighting, let's leave. Yesterday.
Let's hope that Mama wins, ironically.
Yeah, right? Like, it's terrifying. So this game is strategically incredible. There's so much depth to it. There's so much depth to the combat, to the exploration. All of the story is worth your time to read. The races are rad. And then the final battle, where you get there and you turn your ship into a gigantic sentient bomb that you have to go and throw into, like, the ship that the Urquan have or whatever. Yeah, the Saw.
Oh, yeah, your giant battleship is basically like a tugboat as far as the precursors are concerned. It's just, it's a maintenance vehicle. It's not even like a Star Destroyer or anything. It's like a Honda Civic.
Yeah, and you see the actual Saw Matra, which is a real precursor ship, and you're like, oh, this is going to be bad if they get that online. And you basically have to Death Star them. You get, like, when you get to the end game, you have your, like, you know, your Chimur and Shinjesu and whatever. And then out of nowhere, the Reunify Yeehat come, led by a Pekunk Queen, and they're like, we'll give you all of our ships. And I just go in with a full fleet of Yeehat and Pekunk ships, because hell yeah, let's go. And the last battle is super fun and super long. And when you win, you feel like you earned something. Like, the game is real, real just satisfying.
I had to put it down for a day. I ended up getting stuck on that last fight because it had been so long.
Yeah.
The Pekunk are so squirrely. Like, they turn so damn quick that you're just constantly flying into a wall and then getting obliterated.
Oh, God.
And then when you finally have to, like, you know, fly your flying bomb into the ship, like, the little projectiles that knock you around, like, I kept getting ping-ponged out of that slot. Like, it was just like, screw this. I'll do this tomorrow. It's either really easy or really frustrating.
You know, Toys for Bob. I don't know if you've played Skylanders at all, but
not really. I'm aware of it.
There's a character named Persephone. She's a fairy, and she talks like the oars. She says, like, you meet her, she says, like, hello, extremely. And I was like, I get that reference. Well, all these little kids are like, who cares?
Oh yeah, no kid is ever gonna get that.
It is so wild to me that the guys who created one of the greatest sci-fi games of all time went on to make
Skylanders.
Yeah.
It's so bizarre.
You
know
what? You got to stay in business. Whatever you got to do, I get it. But
before that, they were doing like Disney licensed stuff. Like, I don't know. They do like goofy skateboarding. That probably wasn't it, but it was something like that. It's just utterly wasted on that kind of thing.
And I'm like, yeah, they did actually. They worked on Disney's Extreme Skate Adventure.
Oh, shit. So that's for real.
Oh, wow. I almost remembered it.
And Madagascar, you know.
Oh,
and I'm like,
Lord.
Activision takes one of the greatest teams of the 90s and has them making shovelware.
And the 80s even. Like, they were making some of my favorite games for Commodore. Like, the guy was involved in Archon. He was, Mail Order Monsters is still one of my favorites, even if it's a little bit half baked. It's like a precursor to so many other, like, monster collecting and battling games.
Yeah. I mean, these guys, oh my God, Archon's such a good game. Archon is still perfect. But, like, StarCon 2, though, man, like, if this is the only game that you make, you've made the perfect game. Right?
Yeah,
like,
I agree. It
prefigured so much stuff that came like 15 years later. They basically accidentally made like an open world RPG.
That's exactly
it.
It's an open world RPG. You have no direction. You're like, the only direction you're given in the beginning is you can go this way. That's where the Spathi are. Otherwise, explore. The first Gatchant you see, you'll run into a Melnorme. They'll tell you something, and you just go poke around, and you will eventually run into aliens and start messing around. And it's wild. Like, when I was starting up the game again, I had forgotten how little direction the game gives you.
Yeah, it gives you nothing.
And that's amazing. You would never get away with that today. Like, you would never be able to just throw someone into space and say, good luck, go. And that's just like, what?
But then, you know, flash forward months later after you've explored the game, and it's like, you have an itinerary. It's like, I know where the rainbow worlds are. I'm going to hit that shit first. I'm going to put hellbore cannons in the front of my ship.
Hell yeah, you are.
I wasted a lot of time just farming through, because every planet I saw, I wanted to explore and farm and, you know, look at the
find your
alien
gold worlds
life.
And ruby worlds
and ruby worlds, because a lot of them are pretty, and I love the music for, like, a lot of the orbit music as well. So
it's weird to think about, like, this game is so old now, like, people hadn't discovered exoplanets back then.
Yeah, it's like, I was looking at that today.
Oh, like, my God, yeah, you're right,
Pluto was still a planet. So
but we never seen another planet around another star. Like, it
that's
was just
so wild.
It makes you feel old, huh?
Oh, it really does. When you
1992
put it that way.
Was 30 years ago.
No, it wasn't. That's a lie. It's got to be a lie.
30 years ago.
Man. And yet it doesn't feel dated in the least.
Oh, my God. No, the game doesn't. And kudos to the Urquan Masters team for keeping this thing alive. And the fact that I can play this on my friggin', I mean, I could play it on literally any platform I want, which is just insane.
That, and there's so much fan stuff too. People are still doing remixes of all the music. There are people who made like full on campaigns that you can plug into Urquhart Masters, like their own little sequels and stuff.
That's so good.
Like just playable fan fiction, basically.
Have you played the HD version?
I haven't.
Yes.
I downloaded it. Yeah, and it's like it's good. But I'm looking at the captain of the space station, Hayes or whatever his name is. And I'm like, hey, he's wearing a name tag. I never noticed that before. my name is Hayes. I'm about to die.
I just noticed like his space station rave music.
I love that. I'm such an immature idiot.
You should just be twirling glow sticks.
Yeah, I know. Look, the game is very 90s. Let's be real. It's 90s version of the 50s is what it is.
Yeah, that's pretty apt.
But man, it does it so well. And I think honestly, like I had a friend of mine who has never played it before. I was like, man, you got to play Starcon. And he did. And he really enjoyed it. And I mean, yeah, there's some parts that are a little janky. Some of the puzzles are a little annoying. And I don't blame anybody for using a fact. But also half the fun is exploring and like dealing with it and figuring it out. And I seriously, the game absolutely holds up today.
No, for sure. No, it's a great game, great influence.
Oh my God. I can just visualize all of it. And even now though, like periodically I'll throw the GIF up of the Urquhart, like just the Urquhart dude. And it's like, oh my God, that's horrifying. Please don't do that. Cause like, I can hear that martial music of just them coming at you. And you're like, that is even on like
it's images you can hear. Yeah.
Yeah.
Images, right? Exactly.
I have an old GIF I made like back in the 90s of the Urquhart, like in front of an American flag.
I remember that GIF.
Twitching tentacles and stuff. I used to use that for like fake campaign websites.
Still relevant.
I would still vote for an Urquhart right now.
I mean, yeah, vote for Urquhart. They'll just enslave you.
Well, at least they'll give you a new planet. Ours is pretty much on the brink.
They call it healthcare.
Yeah, unfortunately, yes. That is the... Oh, man, what a weird game.
Yeah,
weird
man. Game. So, Starcon 2, it's influenced basically every sci-fi game you've ever played. It still remains one of the best CRPGs. And like everybody you've ever heard of, people who played like Fallout or BioWare, all these guys have all played Starcon. It shows up in everything because they did it right. They did combat right. They did story. I don't think there are many games that have got the kind of nuance and story that this text prompt did. Even though it's like literally just reading pages of Notepad, it still makes you emotionally invest in the game in a way that a lot of things today feel a little too handholdy. This one gives you a lot of hooks and it lets you make these connections. And you can feel the D&D DNA in this from like the way that the storyteller feels like a DM who is giving you plot hooks and then letting you make your own int rolls to figure out what these things actually mean. And I love that. I love that so much.
I think it's interesting that maybe not a lot of people played this game, but a lot of game developers played this game. Like universally is just it's always cited as an influence.
Right. It's like your favorite game maker's favorite game, right?
Yeah. If you're interested in making games, play this game. You'll learn a lot just from how it's put together and honestly how ambitious it was. Like I absolutely believe when, you know, they've said that, you know, they worked unpaid for like the last few months on this just because it was too big.
It really is a game that you feel like the creators believe in 100% and still believe in. Yes. It really carries that heart. You can always tell.
And it also explains why they didn't come on for the sequel. Just there was no way they were going to do that again so soon, I think.
Man,
no, for sure.
I was so excited when Star Control 3 came out. Like, because I was young, I didn't know any better about, like, you know, politics or anything. I was just like, my favorite game of all time has a sequel. I'm going to get it. Yay. And Starcon 3 was weird. Like, first off, what I remember is that New Adventures in Hi-Fi, the REM album, came out, and I basically played the hell out of it because the Starcon 3 soundtrack sucked. So I just used the Redbook audio, put in the REM CD, and just looped my favorite songs from that album over and over while I played Starcon 3. They did some cool little tricks to add in races that link backwards to Starcon 2.
Yeah.
But the biggest sin they did was they took the sprite work from the first game, which was stunning, and replaced it with real cruddy early 90s CG.
No, man. They most of it were puppets. Yeah. Like they built puppets for these characters. And like you would think on the surface, this would be something I would really like. I'm way into freaking weird puppet shit.
Yeah.
But no, they look terrible.
They look like bad claymation horrors.
That's what I thought. I thought they were claymation.
Yeah. They're puppets and animatronics, and they just don't work.
Yeah.
Especially given how much character the other ones had. And like differing styles, even though there's pixel art, you know, you can see like a differing artistic style with each of the different species, you know, and they each kind of harken back to a certain kind of like pulp art. Like, you know, like the Siren or pure Frank Frazetta.
Yes, exactly. The worst one was the Erlu. In StarCon 2, they look like traditional green aliens. In StarCon 3, they're these fleshy. You know, have you ever seen those like pictures of what would Homer Simpson look like if he was real?
Yeah.
And it gives this weird fleshy ugliness. That's what they turned the Erlu into. And I was like, how could you take like a very classic race and just make them look suddenly terrifying?
Also gave them a really, like, as I recall, the backstory for the Erlu in 3 was just really a letdown. Like, wasn't interesting at all. Like, apparently they were using us to harvest our DNA, or I don't know, something very non-Ari.
Like they missed all the charm.
Yeah.
And they went straight to horror.
Exactly.
And it's like, okay, that's fine. But like, the whole point is that these people were protecting us and they're caring for us. Yeah, they're, you know, harvesting DNA or whatever, but it's not like, but there's a difference in the way that they're presented.
They're not just monstrous. They have an agenda. It's maybe a little creepy, but and it exists in juxtaposition to like just the frivolity and the whimsy of the rest of it.
Yeah.
Like it seems that much more horrifying when it's placed against like just how goofy everything else is.
Yeah,
exactly that. I mean, Star Control 3, it had some really fun things. It had like, they added a new system where you go through and you can like get resources and then use those to build up new ships and build new bases, and it lets you kind of colonize through space, which is really fun and really
interesting. It's kind of a callback to the first one, like where you would like build ships and occupy star systems, and there was a little bit of a strategy game to it.
It adds a light 4X-iness, but it's not, it misses the soul of what made StarCon 2 good. Like the story is kind of just there, but it feels really patched on. It feels like a fanfic. That's what it is. StarCon 3 feels like somebody really liked StarCon 2 and tried to make a fanfic and did not have the ability to handle it.
If you're into theaters, it's the Love Never Dies of video games.
I mean, you know that Legend was capable of making good games. They just didn't know what to do with this.
Yeah, and it sucks. It sucks.
And then Accolade sat on the trademark for so long. And you keep saying StarCon, it keeps reminding me, like, they had plans of making another sequel, but like they were going to make it like a 3D space shooter, like a mission-driven kind of thing. And I've only ever seen like a couple screenshots in magazines because apparently it didn't make it very far. But yeah, they were just going to call that StarCon.
Oh.
And it just never happened. I'm honestly kind of glad it didn't.
That's very 90s somehow.
Oh, early 2000s. Yeah, this is like when like they were doing like, here's Star Trek, except you fly little space fighters. Like, okay, what part of Star Trek is that?
Seriously.
I would actually say that, like, this is the best Star Trek game. Like, that's not a Star Trek game.
Yeah, you know what? That's true. That's true. It definitely – and then Stardock. And then Stardock happened.
Oh, Stardock. Yeah. Now, I don't know a whole lot about the lawsuit, just that it was messy. Stardock, they bought the Star Control name, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Basically, what happened is Stardock bought the name to Star Control and wanted to make their own thing and started making this weird game with it. And then Ford and Reich were like, yo, we still own all the races and like story bits and everything about this game. You can't just do that. You can make a Star Control, but you can't use any
more. You have
the
trademark. You don't have the entire copyright.
Yeah, right. And it went kind of ugly and got weird. And then they patched it up. And now when you go to like the Stardock Star Control page, they've got links to all three of the originals. But their version of their game that they made is like, they call it Star Control Origins. So it was basically meant to be like, instead of being like a sequel like they originally intended, they made it into like a super prequel. And I don't know, nobody's ever played it. Nobody ever talked about it once it came out. It's a Stardock game. So like, you know.
I didn't even know it existed. So
it's one of those things where you're like.
I think I remember I got a request to review it from them when I was in games writing. And I was like, nah, I don't think I'll do that, but thank you very much.
Yeah, like, I don't think anybody has ever looked at, played at, or thought about this game. Like, I don't even think it has a Wikipedia page. That's how much people... Oh, no, it does. It does. It came out in 2018, for God's sakes. But it's a game that nobody cares about. Play the real StarCon. It's still there. Urquan Masters, you can get it. It's on every platform you want.
I'm actually surprised that Star Control, the original, was on the Genesis, and I wonder how it ended up there. The same way I wonder how did Star Control 2 get on 3DO.
3DO of all things. I guess it was just too early for PlayStation or Saturn or anything,
yeah,
and it wasn't going to go on Super Nintendo. So
put it up. Let's not go on Super Nintendo. Come on, do it.
Can you imagine? A, that would have been awesome. B, there's no way a Super Nintendo would have been able to deal with this.
Not in a thousand years. No, but
like, no way.
If they had come up with like a truncated version, that might be pretty good for what it is. Kind of like how you did get a lot of computer games and Super Nintendo and Genesis. But I wonder why the original never came to the Super Nintendo, but it did go to the Genesis.
Yeah, it's an odd one.
Genesis was probably cheaper to license, too.
Oh, shit, right. Yeah, you got a point there.
Oh, also, yeah. Mega Drive was way bigger in Europe, too.
That's a good point. That's right.
But also, like, it's so... I mean, I saw the 3DO version once, and I'm like, the 3DO is a weird system.
It is.
But it was cool, so I was like, okay,
It has some cool deviations, I think, that very much of its time. It's kind of trapped in a bubble, like kind of like the TurboGrafx 16.
Or CDI. Or CD. Yeah, it was that era where nobody quite knew what to do with CD-ROM, so you're getting shit like MTV's Club Dead.
That's a flashback right there.
Burn Cycle.
Burn Cycle. Good old Burn Cycle. Never played it, but it looked interesting.
Well, this is Retronauts, right? So, StarCon 3, it exists. It's fine. You can get on good old games if you really, really want to.
I don't have plans to play it.
StarCon 2, worth playing even today. That's all I got to say.
Absolutely.
Right? Oh, yeah. I play through it almost every year. It's easy to come back to, and it's just it's just great.
We all have that game we all come back to, and that's mine. I think Secret of Mana is probably mine, but I can understand why Star Control would certainly be a really good game to come back to. For me, it was a big comfort when I was having a really hard time, so I'm glad it exists.
Yeah.
All right, so I guess we've kind of come to the end of this one, because what do you got, Nadia? What are your last thoughts for Star Control 2?
Well, briefly, I want to mention that hopefully we'll get a follow-up, because there is talk from Ritchie and Ford about, I think they just recently made their own company after Activision put Toys for Bob in the Call of Duty mines, which really pisses me off because...
Call of Duty duty?
They're on Call of Duty duty until the end of time. And Toys for Bob, even they've always been an extremely talented and good developer. You know, even though Skylanders might not be everyone's cup of tea, there's a lot of care and it's a solid platformer. Like, it's an okay game. And they did a great remake of the Crash games, and they did they do Spyro? I can't remember, but they did Tony Hawk, I think.
Yeah.
And then Activision says, oh, well, hope you like being in the minds of Call of Duty forever, because I guess Tony Hawk didn't sell a billion jillion copies or whatever ridiculous number they had in their mind. But thankfully, Ford and Ritchie are kind of on their own thing, doing a company called Pistol Shrimp, I think.
Yeah, that was it.
You know, those guys deserve way better. They deserve to be up there with like Sid Meier level conversation, because the games that they've come up with are just so monumental. I mean, there's so many games that are like, this is one of the best games of all time.
But most devs don't have like a single thing like that under their belt, much less like several things that defined aspects of genres. And then to be like so misused consistently misused for so long.
Right.
It's like you have like this magical artifact and you're using it to open cans or some shit.
Right. Like, what are you doing? Why? These guys deserve to be like leading multiple games, not just making shovelware.
No, they're a treasure because they are like older devs who've been around since the very beginning. You don't get people like that in this industry.
Right, who are still doing this, you know?
It's still like, doing it, yeah.
All right, man. So what about you, Sharky? What do you got? Final thoughts for Star Control 2?
My final thoughts is like, if you played it, play it again. If you haven't played it, play it now. You'll see echoes of it in so many things that you probably didn't recognize before.
Yeah.
That's just fun.
My only suggestion is just be patient. Your ship sucks in the beginning. Just go buy some thrusters as soon as you can. It'll make your life a lot better. Trust me on this.
Come at it like you would like a FromSoft game. Like, it's going to drop you in there. It's not going to insult you with a tutorial. It's going to assume you're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
You can put the story together yourself. We're not going to explain
everything. Well,
Elder,
you did have to jump down a hole to get the tutorial. That was pretty great.
Star Control is the Dark Souls of Star Trek.
What a perfectly horrible note to end on.
All right. Well, I will hand it back to you, Nadia. Sorry.
Oh, no. Like, I am, like, that's basically what I wanted this episode to be. I wanted us to just sit around and gush about Star Control. Let's face it, anyone who's going to listen to this episode, that's all they're going to want. They're going to want to hear about the good times and what makes the game unique and all that fun crap. And I think we really had a good time speaking about that.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But that is actually all for this episode of Retronauts. And thank you guys so much for joining me. Let's take this space to promote things that are going on. How about you, Sharky? Anything cool going on in your life?
Oh, nothing I can talk about.
Awesome.
Just stuff that falls the outside Sharky. The normal ethics gradient.
So you're doing Sharky stuff, basically.
Basically, yeah. I'm still Evil Sharky on Twitter.
Awesome.
Good time.
And Shiva, I know you have stuff.
Yeah, so I host a podcast about Magic the Gathering called Casual Magic. It comes out every Tuesday on every podcast and on YouTube every Thursday. And you can find me on Twitter at Electrotal, or if you care about my magic stuff, at Gear Boy Gears. And you can hear me on like half a dozen Retronauts episodes about like Street Fighter or Suikoden or Civilization, whatever Parrish is like, oh, this is a Shivan game. Okay, we're going to call him.
It's a Shivan game. Call him in here.
But yeah, you'll probably hear me on more Retronauts because I come on this show a lot.
You do. And we hear you on Blood God as well. You DM'd our
that was so much fun.
Session. Yeah, no, that was a lot of fun. Again. Yeah, we will, actually. you're going to hear about that. So,
what about you, Nadia? Where can the people find you?
Basically, I'm at Nadia Oxford, and I also do the Axe of the Blood God RPG podcast. It's a RPG podcast about RPGs, old, new, Eastern, Western. I do a lot of writing behind the scenes. I'm in like a lot of game localization now, so I'm here and there. I am definitely part of the Retronauts crew, so you will hear from me roughly every month. So keep on listening, and we'll... talk more Star Controller stuff and, well, not more Star Control, but hey, who knows in the future, who knows what it'll bring. But if you like Retronauts itself, if you think this episode is cool, we have a lot more content like it. Just visit the Retronauts Patreon at patreon.com/Retronauts for access to media that's even more explosive than a show fixedy glory device. I actually wrote that. Jesus, sorry. Support us at the $3 level to receive early access to weekly episodes. Supporting us at the $5 level gets you... episodes a week early, and as well as 2 exclusive episodes a month. Support us at the magic number 64 for the opportunity to set a Retronauts topic of your choice once every 6 months. As of recording, there are 2 spots left, so go ahead and snap them up. As for me, like I said, I'm Nadia Oxford of the Axe of the Blood God podcast, and you can support us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod and or follow me on Twitter at Nadia Oxford. Until then, thank you for listening, and all glory to Culture 12. We'll be right back.